What we're about to get into with Dr. Cialdini here are the most important psychological principles that you guys can implement. The implementation of these principles that we're about to discuss here will result in you being more liked, trusted, well-known. It will make you millions of dollars. It will help you build your business. And no matter how good of a packaged product you have, no matter how good of a service you have, if you don't employ these six principles that we're about to discuss, you will be fighting an uphill battle.
Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast.
Stand back while I celebrate freedom.
The show where we help you achieve financial independence with the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps from guests who've already earned their freedom.
The flags of freedom fly.
Choose to do what you want.
What you want.
With who you want.
With who you want.
When you want.
When you want.
With another episode today. Now, here's your host, Brian Lubin.
Guys, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. This one is a fangirl episode for me. The author, the guest on today's podcast is not somebody with a brand new book that they're releasing. It's not somebody that has the new sexy idea, the new sexy strategy. The book that this guy released was from 1984, and it is single-handedly, I think, the best book on psychology for marketing, for sales, for persuasion. The book's called Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion by none other than Dr. Robert Cialdini. Robert's currently 78 years old, and I will read his bio. Robert Cialdini is an American psychologist and academic. He is a Regents Professor of Psychology at Arizona State University and was visiting professor of marketing, business, and psychology at Stanford University. Not too shabby. I originally read Robert's book back in maybe 2016, I believe, when I was going through sales training. I wanted to do some extra work. I was looking up sales books, psychology books, so I can perfect my craft when I was putting my 10,000 hours in the sales profession. And the book changed my life. It 10x my income, 10x my life. I use the principles today. And it's funny because he wrote it in 1984 before the internet was even a thing. And now this book has essentially become the Bible for online sales and marketing. So a lot of you guys are probably familiar with Russell Brunson with ClickFunnels and Alex Hormozi, who's a huge entrepreneur online right now. And both of these people directly credit Robert in this book to helping them build their businesses. And it's funny because Robert has no idea who they are. We talk about it in the interview. I said, do you know who Russell Brunson is? And he goes, no. And I'm like, well, he's made hundreds of millions of dollars and he directly credits you. So I thought that was kind of funny point in the interview today. Before we get going today, I want to preface this episode with a bit of a disclaimer. It's a bit slower than usual. So Robert's more reserved, calm with his manner of speaking. And so I adjust my tonalities and my cadence to match his. So while you normally are used to hearing me go 100 miles an hour, essentially me and the podcast guests are on shots of espresso talking about financial freedom, this one is going to be a bit more reserved. I would invite and both challenge you to finish this episode all the way through. And most likely you will need to listen to this a couple of times and take notes when you're not driving, because this message and these six principles we discussed today are life-changing, and they will directly help you with your life and your business. My one ask, as always, is if you're enjoying this podcast, send this to some friends, send this to some colleagues, help me grow the show. Organic is the best method of growth for the podcast, and I would greatly appreciate it, and it will help your friends and family as well. So without any further ado, let's get to the show. Dr. Robert Cialdini, how are you, my friend?
I am well, Brian. I hope the same is true for you.
Absolutely is. This is a very cool full circle moment for me, because I remember 5-6 years ago picking up a copy of your book, the original Influence, Psychology of Persuasion. And I was in a sales position. I was in B2B enterprise sales. And that book was one of my favorite books I believe I've ever read on sales and marketing and influence in general. So I wanted to say thank you, first and foremost, for creating the book and writing the book. And my first question to you is, what got you interested in the grand macro fields of psychology and persuasion in general?
I think it has to do with all my life, I've been a sucker. I've been pushed over for the appeals of various people, with the salespeople or fundraisers and so on, who would come to my door. And I would always wind up saying yes to things I didn't really want, contributing to causes I really didn't know about. And it occurred to me, wait a minute, there must be something other than the merits of the offer then that got me to say yes. It was the way the merits were presented, the psychological factors that were harnessed by the delivery of the message that made it so attractive to me, this offer. And I thought to myself, this is worth studying. I think a lot of people would be interested in knowing what are the laws of persuasion that get you to take the same message, the same case, the same product or service, and elevate its attractiveness by the way you present it persuasively. I thought, not just out of self-defense, I wanted to learn about this, and I thought I would make it my mission to study the influence and persuasion process as an academic scientist, as a behavioral scientist, once I had the chance to produce that kind of research.
Absolutely. And now you released the first book, the original book, in 1984, which I didn't even realize it was that long ago when I had picked it up, because it's funny how pertinent the information was when I read it even 5-6 years ago, as it was in 1984. And it translated really well.
People have asked me, so they say, you know, that book Influence that you wrote is the Bible of online sales, right?
Yes.
But how, there wasn't such a thing as online sales when you wrote it. How could you look forward into the future and recognize what was going to be effective? And I have to say, truthfully, I didn't look forward. I looked inward. I looked inside of us as a species. What are the factors that have always moved us toward assent, toward agreement, toward yes, when we are confronted with a proposal, a recommendation, a request? What are the things that have always characterized the decision to move forward with a communicator who wants to partner with us in some way? And if you look back over our history as a species, there, it turns out there aren't a lot of those universal principles, but there were, at when I first looked, 6 of them that stood out that always have had power over us. And they will likely have power over us 50 years from now because they're part of the human condition. They're not part of the times. There are things that are part of the time, but these are more durable than that. They tend to be there driving behavior throughout our history. So I thought that's why they showed up in online platforms. And I saw an article, a couple of researchers looked at 6,000 commercial online sites that had done A/B tests with various factors that would influence conversions to the, from prospect to customer. And they looked at 29 factors, some economic, free shipping, some technological, there's a search function within the site that you can use, some that were sales oriented. There was a call to action line at the end. And they ranked those 29, and the top were the psychological principles of persuasion that have always moved people in your direction. Scarcity, authority, commitment and consistency, social proof. These are the kinds of things that if you load them into any kind of message on any sort of platform are going to be successful.
100% agree. And so I'm curious, as you, so you released an updated version of the book in 2021. So I'm curious, as time has progressed, and I completely agree with you, humans, it's like the more we change, the more we stay the same. And so it's funny, it almost reminds me back when you read like the old Stoics, like Marcus Aurelius, Seneca, and you read their principles of old Stoicism and the ancient Greek philosophers, the same principles apply today with how they viewed life, right?
That's right, because that's who we are.
Fundamentally.
We are. And those things have always moved us correctly. If you have identified the principles that move people successfully in a particular direction, you've identified the principles that people rely on to move them effectively toward good outcomes. Things like we've just talked about, seizing scarce opportunities when they're dwindling, listening to the voices of genuine authority, listening to or looking at the trends in terms of what your peers are doing and so on. All of those things have always steered us correctly. So a communicator who employs them, who embeds them in a message, harnesses these big forces that have been installed inside us all. It's like they reach in, like there are these strings inside us. They reach in and they strum them and they resonate to change. These are the things that resonate with the idea of making a change, of going forward within us. And so the idea of putting them in a book, which I did, one to a chapter, each of these six universal principles. And in the new version, I've added a new one. I've added 120 new pages because there's a lot more research on the factors that influence us. And though this, I have to say, Brian, the book has been good to me.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's been good to a lot of people.
Well, and it sold more copies than I could have sensibly imagined when I wrote it, in all kinds of languages. And here's a reason I decided it's time to write the new version. I have a colleague, a Polish colleague, so there's a Polish version of it. And she wrote to me and she said, Robert, your book Influence is so famous in Poland, my students think you're dead. Now, that's affirming, but it's also sobering, right? It means that I need to get back out there and sure. present this newest work, the newest principles and how they can be harnessed in modern times, for example, online to make. So, for example, here's an example. Nobody would be surprised that liking is one of the principles that causes us to say yes. We prefer to say yes to the people we like. How do you use that online? If you've got an audience you've never seen, you don't have any. So this study I was telling you about, 6,700 online commercial sites, they showed that incorporating the liking principle online significantly increased conversions. How did they do it? They had a welcoming statement at the beginning on their landing page. They just welcome people in to their site the way you would welcome them into your home or into your business. And people felt approved. People liked those who liked them well enough to welcome them. So there are ways in which these principles apply even in technologies that weren't existence back when we first highlighted them.
And I liken the social media element to just, we go through different phases as a civilization, as a culture. You had people that were oral storytellers and that translated into the written word. And then that translated into the online climate and now even to the audio format here, because whenever I am doing this, I do this once a day. So this is a daily show. So people listen to me 5 to 10 hours a week. And so they know and trust me. So I frequently talk to people that want to buy my goods and services and my business, and they want to support my business, that know everything that I've done for the last 2 years because they know and trust me and they listen to me. So I'm curious. I want to dive really deeply into each one of these six core principles of persuasion. But first, I want to actually preface that with, what are some common misconceptions people have that you've ran into about persuasion?
Probably the biggest is that you should have a favorite persuasive approach. That should be the one that you use in all situations because that's the most powerful, that's the most effective one. And I think that's wrong-headed because importing some principle into a situation where it's not a good fit, just isn't going to be successful. The optimal way to proceed is to locate what principle or principles are already there in the situation. They're in, their engine is running. All you have to do is engage their power because they're already there. You point to them. You raise them to consciousness in the minds of your audience. And because they typically steer people correctly, they will be the ones you should employ. The ones that are inherently, naturally present in the situation already, that your job is to uncover and bring to the surface like a detective would, like a sleuth would. You uncover what's there, the true cues as to what, how to solve the problem and raise it to consciousness in your audience.
I love that. And that was actually going to be one of my questions. So we're going to scrap that one and throw it out the window. Which one is your favorite? Of course not. We're not doing that. Before we dive in here, I want to really drive this point home for the audience. So what we're about to get into with Dr. Cialdini here are the most important psychological principles that you guys can implement. The implementation of these principles that we're about to discuss here will result in you being more liked, trusted, well-known. It will make you millions of dollars. It will help you build your business. And no matter how good of a packaged product you have, no matter how good of a service you have, if you don't employ these six principles that we're about to discuss, you will be fighting an uphill battle. So, Robert, I would invite you to take us down this rabbit hole, man. Let's go into the six principles.
Let's talk about the first one that I always present first because it's so fundamental to who we are. It's the principle of reciprocation. It concerns a rule that exists in all human societies. There's not a culture, a human culture on earth that fails to train its members in this rule that says, you have to give back to those who have first given to you. If you don't, in all human languages, we have very nasty names for people who take without giving in return. We call them moochers or takers or ingrates or teenagers, actually. And nobody wants to be labeled like that. So the implication is if we give first, not waiting for them to move in our direction by saying, you sign our contract and we will give you the best possible service, or you buy our product and we will make sure that you are happy and satisfied with it because of what we've built in. No, this is saying we go first. We give benefits, we give advantages, we give information, we give products, samples, we give positive attitudes and ethical approaches and so on. We give effort in their behalf. For example, there was a study done in the UK. People whose job it was in an employment, government employment agency, was to get people who were not working back on the job. And they would arrange interviews with them, with companies that were looking for help. Many of those people didn't appear for the interviews. They liked being...
This applies to 2023.
They liked being unemployed and getting government benefits. So they didn't show up, right? Until the researchers did this one thing. They said, not just we've made this appointment for you, James, at 2 o'clock at business XYZ. They said, we made this appointment for you at 2 o'clock. And let me tell you what we did to get it. And then they recounted the steps that they had to take in order to arrange this interview with the right person at the right time and so on. And just describing the effort involved now caused the recipients of this appointment to put in their effort with their turn. And 100%. They did. The number of appointments that were kept shot up dramatically. So what was interesting to me about this was all that effort had already been engaged before they said so. Mm-hmm. They just hadn't said so. They just hadn't raised the idea of an effortful commitment or a gift for you or an active action in your behalf to consciousness. So it's not that you have this principle available. You have to raise it to mind in the person who you're dealing with for it to take an effect. You have to make it top of consciousness, right?
Correct.
Front of mind. Remember in high school and in college, in our math classes and physics and so on, if you had a test or homework and you had some equation to solve or some problem, the instructor would say, show your work. Don't just show me the end product. Show your work. And then I will know that you have done something correctly.
I love that.
So that's what this study showed. You just have to show your work when yeah. you've done something for somebody, and they will reciprocate with work in your behalf.
What I've seen to be true with this in the online space is over and over again, people come to me and they say, hey, I have this good, I have this service, I want to begin a podcast, I want to write a book, I want to do this thing, I want to launch it and then launch that service. But what, like how I've seen it and how I know it to be true is the longer that you can give without any expectation of return and not make an ask, the longer you can build that runway, the larger the ask can be. So it's goodwill compounded over a longer period of time. So I was able to build a 6-figure going on 7-figure business very quickly because I gave this podcast for free without expectation of return to the listeners that are listening now for over a year. No advertising, no nothing. It was just me giving and giving. So for advice for the audience, when you're thinking about this, apply this in your business, what Robert's talking about. And also, if you are signing up for a coach or a business online today, and everything is behind a paywall, that's a red flag. You avoid that person. Right. The more people that give all of their best stuff away for free and they sell the implementation of it, that's a quality service. That's a quality provider.
And it's like putting money in a bank account.
It's deposits.
It gets its own interest. It compounds there because you've been putting it in. And when you want to call it out, man, there's a lot there for people to want to give back to you.
I love that. So let's go on to number two, commitment and consistency.
Yeah. People want to be consistent with what they have already committed themselves to, especially in public. So you want to show people that you live up to your promises, that you act in the same way as what you say you're going to do and so on, that you're not a wishy-washy individual who changes, who says one thing, does another, and so on. You want to show people that, but you also want to show yourself that you have that kind of integrity. And so what happens is if we can see what another person has done, or we can ask a person to take a small step in our direction that is congruent with a larger step or a purchase that we have later, they become significantly more likely to say yes to that larger request because it's consistent with what they have already said or done. And people want to be that. Here's the best example I know is from a restaurant that was in Chicago named Gordon's Restaurant. They were beset with the same problem that exists for all restaurateurs. It's no-shows, people who book a table and then they just don't appear. Very expensive for everybody concerned. And so this guy, Gordon Sinclair, who was a student of the influence process, listened to what his receptionist said when she took a reservation. It was, thank you for calling Gordon's Restaurant. If you have to change or cancel your reservation, please call. We've heard that many times. That's standard. Gordon asked her to add two words to that, right? Which was, instead of thank you for calling Gordon's Restaurant, Gordon's, please call if you have to. He asked her to say, will you please call if you have to change or cancel your reservation, and then to pause and let people commit themselves to coming on time or calling ahead. And everybody said, yes, of course, I'm glad to. No shows at Gordon's restaurant dropped by 64%
wow.
that day and never went back up because you got people to say publicly, actively to you what they plan to do.
Wow. Have you ran into or spoken with Russell Brunson by chance?
I don't think I have, no.
So it's funny because he's made hundreds of millions of dollars off of your strategies and he references you quite a bit in his messaging. So he's one of the guys that founded like online marketing. He's one of the large online marketers. And so what he does online is he will do what's called a low ticket offer and then a high ticket offer. So if he has a $1,000 product or service, what he will do is he's not going to lead with that. He's going to give you a $5 or $10, like he'll give you his book for free. You just pay for the shipping and handling. So it maybe liquidates that advertising cost and you get the book, you pay maybe $7-$8. And then afterwards, he asks you, hey, we also have this thing. We also have this thing. And then that's basically the creation of the online sales funnel is based off of your principle.
He's turned a prospect into a customer.
Correct.
And now with the self-definition of customer, right, you are willing to go further to purchase from within that environment of offers and possibilities.
Right? Correct.
So what I always recommend, I don't know how many people who are viewing this podcast are in management positions, but a lot of people are. And if you are, a lot of times you have a meeting with your team and you have assignments that you give to various people in that meeting to complete before the next meeting, right? And come back with this task accomplished. And here's what I always recommend. Don't let anybody out of the meeting until you use the words, will you be able to come back to the meeting next week with a properly completed task or paper or white paper, whatever it was. And it doesn't matter what the answer is, it's going to be good. If the answer is no, a manager needs to know that. That means I have to extend the timeline or provide resources for this person or maybe a staffer to assist. But if they say yes to you publicly, actively, you have significantly increased the likelihood that they will come properly prepared because they're on record. You've asked them to reply to the words, will you? And you've paused to let them fill that pause with a commitment.
So it's essentially changing one word, can you, to will you?
Yes.
I'm going to implement that immediately.
Never asking the will you at all. It's just saying, come back with this, and then changing that to will you, where you get a chance to get them to make an active, public, voluntary commitment to what you're asking them to do.
I remember to put my sales tie back on for a second, because I forget that I put my 10,000 hours in there already. At the end of every sales presentation, it doesn't matter how well the presentation went, unless you have very clearly defined and agreed upon next steps. Because what happens is a lot of inexperienced reps will go in, they'll have the best meeting of their life. Their manager will say, how was it? They'll say, it was great. The product, they loved it. Everything is great. And he's like, when are you meeting next? And he goes, oh, I told him I'd call him and we'd book a time next week. No, it's when are you free? Can you get your calendar out? Will we meet at this day at this time? Is this fine? And now I'm thinking about it. It's the exact same principle.
It's the exact same thing. It's getting people on record. Because once they're on record, they want to be true to their word.
What
they've said, and they want to be seen as the kind of person who is true to his or her word. Yeah.
So to piggyback off of appearances and what we look like to the public, let's go into the next one, which is liking. And this one is probably the one that most people are familiar with.
Sure. Nobody would be surprised to know that we prefer to say yes to the people we like. But there are two very small things we can do to increase that rapport before we ask for a request or make a recommendation or proposal. The first is to identify genuine similarities that exist between us and the person we're trying to move in our direction, because people like those who are like them. There was a great study that was done on negotiators who were bargaining in an online, it was a email exchange. They were bargaining and they were told, if you can't come to a agreement in a certain amount of time, then neither of you wins anything. You walk away with nothing. If you can't come to an agreement, a mutual agreement. And because email is maybe the most bloodless communication channel we have ever devised, there's no person there. There's just some letters that appear on a screen. Right? 30% of the time, people would walk away with nothing rather than arranging for some kind of a mutual agreement where both sides got something out of it. Some people would go away with nothing rather than letting the other side have more than them, right? Okay. Unless the researchers asked them to do one thing before they began the bargaining session, and that was to exchange some information with one another about their hobbies, their interests, their family situation, where they went to school, these kinds of things. And after they did that and then launched into the same kind of bargaining situation by email, stymied negotiations went from 30% to 6%.
Wow.
Now, the researchers were thrilled with this because it validated their hypothesis that the more personalized you can make an exchange with somebody, the more likely they are to see you as a human being, not just some sentences that appear, not some remote cipher at a keyboard. But that's not what they found. It turned out, if you look deeply into the data, it wasn't the amount of personalizing information that was sent back and forth. It was whether in that information there were commonalities between the two. You're a runner. I'm a runner. You're an only child. I'm an only child. It was those things that led to yes, that led to agreement. So, before we ever do business with an individual who we know, right, like in a negotiation, we have the internet as our ally. We can find out about that person who tells us all kinds of things. It's not proprietary information. They want us to know this online. And if we find a commonality, a parallel, raise that to consciousness before the negotiation begins. And you reduce the likelihood of stymied or deadlocked negotiations by orders of magnitude. So that's one of the things, is find a genuine commonality. And the other that elevates liking is praise. Find genuine compliments to give to somebody. Once again, it has to be honest, otherwise they're going to see through it. But on it, something commendable about that person that you can remark on, not only do people like those who are like them, they like those who do like them.
That makes sense.
So what you get is a significant increase in compliance with requests for people who have been honestly praised before the request.
See, Robert, I was just completely lying at the beginning of the interview. I never even read the book. I was never even in sales. No, absolutely. And another, to add to what you said in the original point, another thing is everything from like the mirroring process, right? Like tonalities, speed, body language, stuff like this. Absolutely. Because for instance, for people that are listening and they can't see me and you right now, the podcast interview I just got off of was somebody that was in their early 20s and they had maybe taken 3 shots of espresso and they were bouncing off the walls in the interview. And so I matched the energy, right? So they bounce off the walls, I bounce off the walls. Like with me and you, we're having an academic conversation. So I immediately had to flip a switch and I go from bouncing off the walls to now I'm down here to match your tonalities.
Being contemplative and yeah, about what you're saying.
Because otherwise there's an imbalance.
Were you ever a server in a restaurant, a waiter?
No, but I think I would have done well.
I am in the same position. I'm not still
saying I don't want to.
It's with being alike. No, I was never a server, but I think I would like it because it's a people kind of position. I like interacting. But anyway, there's research to show that just as you said, if somebody gives an order, right, you give somebody an order and the waiter characterizes it, that, therefore what you'd like is such and such versus mimics exactly the same words that the person uses. If you use exactly the same words, your tip goes up significantly. People like you more because of that match. You're in sync in this way. Yeah.
And when it comes to copywriting, which is the art of persuasion through copy online, especially, people listening, here's a pro tip that it piggybacks exactly off of what Dr. Cialdini is saying here. And that is when you are creating your messaging for your product, your service, your business, instead of saying things in your words, what you do is you collect customer interviews and you talk to your customer and then you take and you write down what they say, how they say it. And that is your copy. That's your messaging. So you use exactly the phrases that they're using in the exact way. You can copy and paste it. And then they're like, and then when somebody new reads your messaging, they're like, that's exactly how I feel, because it was exactly how they felt. It's what they said.
That's brilliant. That's such a good insight.
That it works really well.
Once again, using something that we have shown to be powerful across populations and settings and situations and circumstances, liking, right? And finding a place for it to implement it along one of the things that causes liking, which is similarity.
And this perfectly transitions into, we went a bit out of order, but it perfectly transitions into social proof, if you want to hit on that a bit.
Sure. Social proof. We live in, I just read an article that uncertainty is increasing dramatically over the years. If you go back into recorded history, you can just see how much more uncertainty there is in the language of people who are interacting with one another. And of course, we live in this information environment that's unlike anything we've ever experienced before on this planet. So much information, so much stimulation. And so what that produces is uncertainties about what we should be doing. There's so many options, so many roads to take and so on. Okay. One of the things that reduces uncertainty is social proof involves evidence of what those around me, like me, are doing. That's the proof of what I should do myself. It's not logical proof. It's not data-based proof. It's entirely social. What are the people around me, like me, doing that reduces my uncertainty about what I should do in that situation, especially if there's a lot of them and they are comparable to me? They're highly similar to me. That means a lot of people, like me, have taken this step. It probably is the right step for me, too. So that's the idea of social proof, that if you can show the popularity of a particular model or option that you have within your array of things to offer, just mentioning their popularity makes them more popular. There was a study done in, actually, Brazil and Colombia.
Lovely countries.
at the McDonald's locations in those two countries. Now, McDonald's sells a lot of fries and burgers and shakes, but they don't sell a lot of dessert. So one of my teammates, Stephen J. Martin, who's a London office, heads up the London division. He was asked to help with these McDonald's locations in Brazil and Colombia to spur dessert sales. And here's what he asked them to do. Half of the people who came in during a particular week, were they took their order, and then the person behind the counter said, "Would you like a dessert?" That's for half of them. The other half were told, "Would you like a dessert? Our McFlurry is the favorite of our visitors at this location." And McFlurry orders went up 55% by just telling the truth, again, uncovering the truth about the social proof that was right there in the situation and bringing it to consciousness.
So I'm thinking of another example, which you're correct. We would have made hell of waiters. We would have been fantastic waiters. Maybe you and I, if the book thing doesn't work out, the podcast thing doesn't work out, we can go and make some money.
Yeah, we can. Maybe we can open a restaurant.
At a restaurant. So I'm not sure if I read this in your book or if I read it in another book or where I remember hearing about this, but it's worked for me as a person that's been at a restaurant before. It's almost irritating when you're at a restaurant, you order your food, you order the appetizers, the wine, the main course, everything. And then at the end, the waiter comes up and says, "Have you saved room for dessert?" Almost, it's just, no, we did not plan for this. We didn't expect this. Of course not. We're not doing this. But a study was done that when they led the conversation with, "Hey, so this is a fantastic restaurant. The steak is phenomenal, but I need to tell you, everyone raves about the cheesecake. At the end of the meal, save room for the cheesecake. It's the best cheesecake." All right. And then the restaurant profits went up like 20-30% overnight. I'm not sure if that was from your book or from another source, but
no, it wasn't
same thing.
From my book, but I know
it was
that.
From your book. Yes.
I know that study. And it's a perfect example of two things that I say. One is you have to put something in mind for people before you ask them for something that they can put something in mind for them that's relevant to that choice. This is wildly popular among our regulars. They love the cheesecake. So you've put social proof in their minds. They're now primed for the dessert, for the cheesecake, before they've ever decided what else they're going to do.
It's funny that you go on.
Yeah.
It's funny that you say that because I don't know if you're familiar with actually how McDonald's is viewed in Brazil. So I lived in Brazil for a couple of months. And so I'm close with Brazil. And in Brazil, I'm not sure if this is the same in Colombia, but McDonald's is actually viewed as a luxury, a treat. So people, when they're growing up, they will have birthday parties at McDonald's in Brazil. Yeah. Because it's like a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
It's insane. So that's social proof.
Social proof. Yeah. So anyway, social proof is wildly popular. And I think if there's anything that's changed since I first wrote about these principles, it's that social proof is so much more accessible now to people because of the internet. We can go online and we can see chat groups and user groups and star ratings for almost anything of what other people around us, like us, have chosen to do. And then we can follow in ways that we never had access to that kind of information until we had the internet that allows that. So while all the principles are still equally powerful, I think, in human behavior, social proof is the more likely to be used of any of them because we have so many opportunities to see what others around us have been saying or doing with regard to a particular opportunity.
And then that transitions into the next one, which is authority.
It does transition very nicely because not only do we reduce our uncertainty about what we should do in a situation by looking at what our peers are doing, the people around us like us? We do the same thing with what the authorities are doing and saying, what the experts in a particular arena have been saying. So if as a communicator, you can recruit the or find and bring to bear in your communication program the voices of genuine authorities on the topic at hand, who are saying things either that recommend your brand specifically or just are congruent with your strengths, the things that are best about your version of your of what you have to offer. And you can list those testimonials in your message. And here's the thing that I think we can do better. The testimonial shouldn't go last or in a click room where that's labeled testimonials.
It should lead.
They should be the first thing people read about your message. Because I want the authority aura to infuse every word of your message, including the first sentence of it. I want people to be more swayed by what you have to say from the beginning, by the fact that there are authority opinions and voices that are consistent with what you're saying. You've now got leverage that you would be tossing away if you wait till people have already processed it and been critics of it without the authority voices saying, no, really, this is good. Don't worry.
That's the foreword of a book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's why they try to get somebody who's a very well-known person in that domain, in the domain of the book, to write the foreword or preface.
Robert, I remember, and we'll get into the last one, which is scarcity in a second, but I remember you saying something in the book, and I can't quite put my finger on which law or rule that it falls under, which category it falls under. And that was, you paint this example of somebody that's in line, and they're standing in a long line, and they need to get to the front of the line because they're in a hurry. And then they try to cut through the line, and people say, no, you can't cut. But then as soon as they change their messaging and say, hey, I need to move to the front, can I cut in front of you because of this reason? Then everyone let them in just because they said, because. Can you expand on that? And which one does that apply to?
So it applies to the fact of commitment and consistency among the people who are arriving. So people need, people prefer reasons to say yes. If you just say, I want to cut in line, in this study, it was to get to go to a Xerox machine, a copying machine in a library. It was the Harvard Library. And in one condition, somebody said, can I cut in front of you because I, all right, just can I cut in front of you? That was the reason. And only 60% allowed. But if that person said, can I cut in front of you because I'm in a rush, 93% said yes. There was a reason, and people need reasons to be consistent with. But here's the key that reflects what you were saying. There was a third condition where they said, can I cut in front of you because I have to make copies? That's not a reason. That's not new. That's not new information. Everybody there.
But it still worked.
Wants to make copies. Everybody wants to make copies. It was a pseudo reason. It was the word because that signaled there was a reason here. And now 92% said yes. It was the word because, not the quality of the reason, that drove the effect.
That's insane.
The word because was crucial. And it fits under commitment and consistency. You want to be consistent with the idea that people have given you reasons. You want to think of yourself as somebody like that, who says yes to those who have reasons for you.
I just remember that because I implemented that in corporate America, and it was hilarious how well it worked. And I was just, and it's in the beginning, it's like in the early pages of the book. And I was just like, oh, I'm going to use that. And I started using it, and I would say, hey, I need you to submit this report because, and then I would say some reason. So normally I would create urgency, which goes well into scarcity, which is the final rule or law of persuasion. I'll let you expand on scarcity and urgency.
Okay. Scarcity is the rule of influence that says people want more of what they can have less of. They're attracted to those offers we can provide them that are unique, that are uncommon, that are dwindling in availability, that would go away unless they moved in that direction soon. And the one big reason that's the case is this idea of loss aversion, which won the Nobel Prize for Daniel Kahneman a few years ago in his prospect theory, that has showed that people are more motivated to avoid losing something than gaining that very same thing. So what loss is the ultimate form of scarcity. It means you can't get it anymore. So that's why scarcity is so effective. This human tendency to value, to prioritize avoiding losses over gains. There was a study done in California. Researchers went door to door offering people an energy audit for their home. They did the audit, checked all the weather stripping and insulation and so on. And for half of these homeowners, they said, if you decide to insulate your home fully, you will save a dollar a day every day. The other half were told, if you fail to insulate your home fully, you will lose a dollar a day every day. It's the same dollar, right? But 150% more people insulated their home under loss language than gain language.
Wow.
So what this... Go ahead.
Please. I'm thinking about how I subconsciously view that, because that's how I view my business, right? Our businesses, we essentially help people become entrepreneurs. So we take people that are in corporate jobs that want to become an entrepreneur, from entrepreneur to entrepreneur. And I was speaking with a woman yesterday who just joined and signed up, and she had a newborn child. And so she was on maternity leave at her corporate job, and she was an accountant. And she said, I've got a couple more weeks of maternity leave, and then I'm going to have to pay somebody else to raise my child while I go back to this job. And so there's this book called Family Board Meeting that essentially says, you have 18 summers with your kids, and that's it. Because then they grow up, and then at 18, they're going to college.
They're going to go away in some way.
Yeah, and you'll see them a couple times a year, but then you have 18 full summers with your kids. And so I mentioned that to her, and then she was like, holy crap, I got to get out of this job now. I got to do this now. So that demonstrates that.
You've told them, you've raised to consciousness what she would lose.
And it's true. It's the same reality. It's just, and that's how I view things as well. I view coaching, courses, mastermind, any type of service like that as the process of buying your time back. So it's just like what you could have done in 5 to 10 years, maybe you do in 1 year. So it's like the question of how much is that loss worth of time?
Yeah. Now, we're not saying that you shouldn't ever tell people about gains and what you will achieve. But don't forget that you can still talk about the benefits and advantages and positive experiences that people will have with your product. You can list all of those and then remind them you don't want to lose these.
Yeah.
So now you get gains and losses working for you. You don't want to miss. You don't want to forego these benefits, these positive 18 years of interacting with your kids fully. You don't want to forego that, Yeah.
And another way I implement that, my business is designed to always increase in price. So I want to perpetually make my service more expensive as time progresses, because the more people that are in it, the more that we improve it, the more expensive it gets. So I always tell people, I'm like, hey, next quarter, this is going to cost more than it does today. And then the following quarter is going to cost probably 25% more, 25% more. We're going to keep going. By today, you buy at this price. If you buy 3 months from now, it's going to be completely separate price.
Otherwise, you lose that price advantage.
Correct. So it's like a gain. So here's your gain today, is your loss tomorrow. So to cover all six principles, once again, ladies and gentlemen, that's reciprocity, commitment, consistency, social proof, authority, liking, and scarcity are the six core principles of persuasion. Robert, is there anything else that you would add for somebody that's listening to this today and they're beginning their persuasion journey? Maybe they identify as more of an introverted person that isn't that great or fantastic with people. It doesn't come naturally to them. What advice would you give them in closing to begin their persuasion journey?
To understand these principles and bring them to the beginning of your appeal, make them active at the start, so you get their energy and their leverage for everything you are going to present from the beginning. Don't wait to build these in later and at the end or in the middle. Have them there early on, and they will be most successful under those circumstances.
You have to plant the garden before you harvest. I love it. All right, Robert, where can people find out more about you, and where can they find and buy the books?
Sure. It's the website influenceatwork.com. All one word, influenceatwork.com. And they'll also see some plans that we have for the launch of a new learning program online and a company called the Cialdini Institute. If they're interested, they can find some information there.
Perfect. Everyone, that's Influence at Work. And the book is Influence, Psychology of Persuasion. He just released a new one in 2021. Go buy the book, go on the website, sign up for the Cialdini Institute. Robert, thank you so much for coming on. This has been an absolute pleasure.
I enjoyed it, Brian.
Thank you so much. And with that, that has been Dr. Cialdini and Brian with the Action Academy Podcast, signing off. Hey, real quick, if you're still listening to today's episode, I'm assuming you got value from it, so I need your help specifically. My 2-year vision with this show is to help over 1 million people do what they want, when they want, with who they want, and I can only do that with your help. There are two main ways that a podcast grows. One is through ratings and reviews, and the other is word of mouth. If you could please leave me a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as well as send this to 1 or 2 friends that you think would get value from it, we can reach the people that we're looking to reach. Thanks in advance. Talk tomorrow.